This is the first day of this November 2008 seven-day session. And we're going to go back to the very beginning of the Zen school and read from a text called Zen Dawn, which is a collection of the earliest Zen texts, and it's translated by J.C. Cleary. It's a little bit about these these texts were lost for some 1,200 years. They dated from the early 8th century. And then they weren't rediscovered until the 20th century in the famous Dunhuang Caves in northwest China. And the publisher describes this as the best information currently available on the early techniques of what is known as the Northern School of Zen Buddhism. Another way to put it was just the when the Zen school was just forming in those earliest times, and it actually begins before Bodhidharma. I think, you know, Bodhidharma, of course, is considered the founder of Zen, but it begins, I think, for the as a kind of a nod to the earlier masters in the ancestral line and the pre-Zen Dharma. It starts with one earlier teacher, so we'll start with him. This collection is we're told was written by a Zong Mi, whose dates are 780 to 841. It describes him here as a Zen master, also recognized as the fifth patriarch of Huayan Buddhism in China. Huayan Buddhism is a different school of Buddhism. There's Zen, Huayan, Pure Land, Tiantai, so this is the guy who allegedly collected these stories. It starts with, first there's a preface that we're going to skip, and then it starts with Guna Bahadra of the Sung period. Sung was an earlier Sung period. There's the famous Chinese Sung period of Dawi, and where koans became systematized. That was in roughly around 1,000. This is an earlier Sung period. We're told here that he was this Guna Bahadra. His full name, they show, was Guna Bahadra Tripitaka, was from South India. I'll be reading here from the actual text as translated into English. When he studied the great vehicle, that is the Dharma, he was called Mahayana. During the Yuanjia years, that's the 5th century, he came by ship to Guangzhou. That's in the very southernmost part of China. That's also where Bodhidharma landed when he sailed from India to China. He came by ship to Guangzhou. Emperor Dai Zhu of the Song received him. He translated the Lankavatara Sutra. The Lankavatara Sutra is one of the several that is most esteemed in the Zen school. The Lankavatara, the Diamond Sutra, the Platform Sutra, the Sixth Patriarch, the Lotus Sutra, the Vimalakirti Sutra. These are ones that we hear about most in Zen. The Lankavatara Sutra was also sort of the core text in these among these earlier masters, and was reputed to be Bodhidharma's main study text. The style of writing here is quite simple, and we can assume that the translator wanted to keep it that way. It was probably reflects this really ancient time. So in one sentence it says he translated the Lankavatara Sutra. That would be a work of decades, maybe, or at least years. Princes and nobles, monks and laymen invited him to give instructions on meditation, but Guna Bahadra was embarrassed and declined because he did not speak Chinese well. That night he dreamed that a man cut off his head with a sword. After that he began to give lessons on meditation. I'll leave it to other people to connect the dots there. And then he first begins, this Guna Bahadra begins by talking about false kinds of meditation that he encountered when he first got to China. I don't think it's worth going through that. Some fall into demonic meditation in order to view all things and find out the good and bad deeds of other people. Some fall into forbidden magical arts, controlling spirits and demons, spying on other people's good and bad deeds. They falsely say, "I sit in meditation and practice contemplation." And then he refers to these as perverse demonic methods. Then he quotes the Lankavatara Sutra. The mind of the Buddhas is supreme. When the Dharma is bestowed in our teaching, where deluded states of mind do not arise, it is this. This is a really profound way of describing Zazen. You notice he doesn't try to say what it is. That would be futile. Instead, he frames it in the negative. He says, where deluded states of mind do not arise, it is this. And this is a good, succinct way of describing it, because if we were to say what it is, then that limits it. Well, it's this, it's that. We're trying to do this, we're trying to create this effect. No, none of that applies in true, fundamental Zazen. It's just the absence of deluded states of mind, which is a pretty rare state, or no state to be in, without even any subtle forms of delusion in the mind. He goes on, ultimately the fruit of enlightenment can only be known for oneself with mind silent. Mindless, we nurture the spirit. Without thought, we pacify the body. I want to just take issue with this translation, the word mindless. Unfortunately, in English, it has a negative connotation. You're just mindlessly plodding along, following your own habits. A better word, I think, is no-mindedly. The point is, that our discriminating mind is not engaged. We're not working with our frontal cortex. All of that is silent. Mindless, we nurture the spirit. Without thought, we pacify the body. Well, the two would go together. When your mind is silent, nothing stirring in the mind, this would quiet the body, settle the body, soothe the body, the internal organs, our whole nervous system, all becomes settled and quieted. Anyone who's been through a 7-day session or even a shorter session knows this, how deeply quieting it is, even physically. He goes on, without preoccupations, we sit in purity, preserving the fundamental and returning to the real. Our Dharma is secret and silent. It is not transmitted by common fools of shallow consciousness. Only people rich in merit and virtue can receive it and carry it out. One of the things I sometimes reflect on when I'm feeling grateful for being in Sesshin is that I'm with, for 7 days, I'm with people rich in merit and virtue. Many people may not think of themselves this way, but at any given moment, our karma, to use a perhaps overused word, our karma can be understood in terms of our circumstances. Here we are. Whatever you may think about yourself, here we are in Sesshin. This reflects, this is proof of wonderful karma. How few people in this world ever find their way into this silence, mind silence. This, I think, is in the same spirit as where the old texts would refer to monks, Buddhist monks, as sons of noble family. Sesshin is difficult, partly because of the physical pain that many people feel at some point, but at least as much so because of the emotional and mental pain, the struggle, the facing ourselves nakedly and having to find our way through difficult states of mind. But we should never imagine that those difficult states, physical or mental states, somehow means that it's some kind of judgment on our karma. That's all background. The main thing is that we're here. We're here and we stick it out to the end. Here's a short paragraph that has a lot packed into it. He says, if you do not understand, if you are not liberated, the sixth consciousness possesses the seventh and the eighth. if you do understand, if you are liberated, the eighth consciousness is without the sixth and seventh. Without getting into a description of these eight modes of consciousness that are found everywhere in Buddhism, all the different schools of Buddhism, let's just say that the sixth is the faculty of thinking and of self-consciousness. The seventh is the sixth, let's just limit it to thinking. The seventh is the seat of ego, or self-consciousness. The eighth is what is beyond self and other. So what he's saying is, if you're not liberated, if you still have not seen into the true nature of things, the thinking mind possesses the ego and what is beyond it. It sort of takes our self hostage. There's nothing bad about having a sense of self. It's just normal human development that we develop a sense of self. We know the difference between ourselves and others, and that's just things as they are. It's when our sense of self is reified, it's hijacked by our thinking mind. In other words, we're thinking about ourselves. We don't need to think about ourselves for the self to function in a way that is effective in the world. But when we dwell in thoughts about ourself and what we identify with, which means the I, the me, and the my, then the sixth, the thinking mind, has hijacked the higher functions. But then he says, if you do understand, if you are liberated, then this mind with a capital M, that's the eighth consciousness, is free of the sixth and the seventh, unnecessary clinging to thought and to the notion of a self. He goes on, those who intend to be Buddhas, that is, to become enlightened, should first learn to pacify mind. Before mind is pacified, even good things are not good. So much the worse for evil. In other words, we want to get beyond good and evil, good as well as evil, thoughts, that is, thoughts of them. When mind becomes peaceful and still, neither good nor evil has any basis. The Wayan Sutra says, phenomena do not see each other, phenomena do not know each other. Or we could say phenomena don't even exist apart from mind. For things are things because of mind, as mind is mind because of things. He goes on, since coming to this country, that is China, I have not even seen people who cultivate the path, much less anyone who has pacified mind. I often see people who go along creating karma, who have not merged with the path. Some are concerned with fame and reputation. Some act for the sake of profit and support. They operate with a mentality of self and other. They act with the attitude of jealousy. What is jealousy? It means to engender the mentality of resentment and hatred, when you see someone else cultivating the path and reaching consummation in principle and practice, so that many people offer that person support and give their allegiance. It means self-satisfied reliance on your own intelligence, not using it to overcome self. This is called jealousy. This is one of the most crippling of all of the hindrances in Sesshin practice, or practice generally, but it becomes more florid in Sesshin, which is to look with envy or jealousy at those who we think are further along in this path than we are. I used to do this. It was such a relief to get beyond it. So if you catch yourself with those thoughts, the best thing you can do is just drop them. Get back to your practice. They only will keep you bogged down thinking about others and what you imagine to be the quality of their practice. That's not our business in Sesshin. We have our own work. And if it's true that other people are further along, it's because they weren't doing that. They weren't thinking about others. Even if you scrupulously perform various practices day and night, cut off afflictions and clear away obstructions, with this kind of attitude, barriers to the path arise one after another, and you do not find peace and stillness. So there are people, he's referring to such people here, there are people with a lot of willpower who can exercise a lot of self-discipline in their mind and exert their will and their concentration. But he says if they are still concerned about others, where they think others are in their practice, then can't find true stillness. And then he takes aim at people who are just trying to do good. He says, even if you practice the six paramitas, or the six perfections, expound the sutras, sit in meditation, and advance energetically practicing austerities, this is just called being good. It is not called Dharma practice. If you do not irrigate the karmic field with the water of desire, if you do not plant the seeds of consciousness there, this is called Dharma practice. If you do not irrigate the karmic field with the water of desire. Strictly speaking, the word karma, we speak of good karma and bad karma, or fortunate karma and unfortunate karma, but the original meaning of the word is we just don't want to create any karma, period. There's no need to divide it into good and bad. We just don't want to generate more karma. So do not irrigate the karmic field with our desires, our cravings. These generate seeds of karma, karmic consciousness. Just now I spoke of pacifying mind. I hate that word, that phrase, pacifying. It just sounds like you're just sort of sinking into, it's like a tranquilizer. But I think it's just an unfortunate translation. It really means bringing the mind beyond thought to this profound emptiness, st- stillness. But it's used by various translators, so I'll probably just no other better simple English way to translate it. Just now I spoke of pacifying mind. In brief, there are four kinds of mentality. First, the mentality that turns away from truth. This is the mentality of those who go through life as ordinary people. Second, the mentality that turns toward truth. This means loathing birth and death and so seeking nirvana and going toward stillness. It is called the Shravaka mentality. Third, the mind that enters truth. Though you cut off barriers to the path and reveal inner truth, subject and object are not yet nullified. This is the Bodhisattva mentality. And fourth, the mind of truth. Not mind outside truth, not truth outside mind. Truth is mind. Mind is able to be everywhere equal, so it is called truth. Truth's awareness can illuminate everything, so it is called mind. Mind and truth are everywhere equal, so it is called Buddha mind, the mind of enlightenment. Let's go through these again. Well, the first is the mind that turns away from truth. We see this in ourselves when we notice in our sitting, we notice that the mind is in thoughts, and we choose to stay there. We choose to go on pursuing the thought or the fantasy. I think often there's this sort of bargaining one does with oneself. Okay, I'll get back to Mu or the breath. I'll get back to my practice in just a few seconds. I just got a little more I want to finish up here with this thought or this fantasy. I'm speaking from experience, you know. But that's fatal. Oh yeah, just a little, a minute or so, and then I'll get back to it. But not right now. That's the mind that turns away from truth. And then this ones that turns toward truth. This is maybe what you could call striving. It's a very very subtle point. The Chinese masters in particular warn students, and this we've read from in Taisho, to not strive. And so a less experienced student will hear this and say, what the hell? What do you mean not strive? And it's not easy to explain this. It really means not striving with the notion of trying to get somewhere out there that's better than here, some point B that we want to get to from this point A. That is what is meant by striving. And that's what he's describing here, turning toward the truth. We don't like impermanence, and we don't like ourselves as we are, let's say, so we want to get away and get to that other place. So that's still not it. And the third is the mind that enters truth. Enters truth, I suppose you could, in very simple terms, just say this is a first experience of awakening. But there's still often the lingering thought of oneself as having attained something. Subject and object are not yet nullified. There's still the thought of an other apart from oneself. Roshi Kapler used to, and he got this from Yasutani Roshi, used to say, well, the difference between a bodhisattva and a Buddha is that a bodhisattva still carries this notion of an other that has to be liberated. It's still a very, very advanced state of wanting to help others, to liberate other beings. But it's different from the absolutely pure state of a Buddha who, as Roshi used to say, who helps others as naturally as breathing, without any self-consciousness, without trying or thinking that there's anyone out there fundamentally who needs help. And yet, help comes, liberation comes, but not with any intention. That's one way of understanding the difference between a bodhisattva and a Buddha. And he says, this is the bodhisattva mentality. And then the fourth we heard, I won't go over that again, the mind of truth. He goes on, the great path is fundamentally omnipresent, perfectly pure, and basically existent. It is not attained from causes. It is like the sun hidden behind floating clouds. When the clouds are gone, the sun appears by itself. So here we could say in this analogy that the clouds come and go on the basis of causes and conditions. Wind, heat, sun, atmospheric conditions. But the sun is beyond coming and going. That is our enlightened nature. No one has more of it than anyone else. No one has less of it than anyone else. It's not something that lands on us at awakening where suddenly we have it, before which we didn't have it. It's beyond all such dualistic ideas. It just is our nature. Enlightenment is our nature. Everyone's nature. We don't have to get it. We don't have to attain it. When the sun appears, it's not that we've gotten it. It was there all along, just obscured. And he says, what's the use of any more learning or views? Why become involved in written or spoken words and come back again to the path of birth and death? Those who take verbal explanations and literary accounts as the path covet fame and profit. They ruin themselves and ruin others. It is like polishing a mirror. When the dust on the surface has been totally removed, the mirror of itself is bright and clear. So this sentence, what's the use of any more learning or views? It's not about acquiring anything. Zen is more a matter of unlearning. That's why I always say what I would hope is that after Taisho, everyone completely forgets everything I've said. There's no need to hold on to my words. There is no one who is without this wisdom. Full disclosure here, this author of this text, this Guna Bahadra, scholars of Zen and Buddhism, raise very compelling arguments that they're not always really the authors behind these words, that it was later monks much later, in fact, centuries later, who composed these works and then became attributed to these early patriarchs. But does it matter? This is the Dharma. Any whoever wrote this stuff knew what they were talking about. They're enlightened. These are enlightened words. And then he quotes the Lankavatara Sutra. The Buddha is not Buddha, nor does he save sentient beings. Sentient beings impose distinctions and think that Buddha saves sentient beings. Thus they do not realize this mind, and they have no stability. That's the quote from the Lankavatara Sutra. And then this Guna Bahadra, or whoever, says, with realization there is awareness and great function amid causal origination, penetrating perfectly without obstruction. This is called great cultivation of the path. There is no duality between self and other. All practices are carried out at once. There is no before or after, and no in between. It is called the great vehicle, the Mahayana. And then he goes through the six paramitas, the six perfections, with the Zen eye, as follows. Having no attainments within or without, the great ultimate relinquishment. This is called dana paramita, the perfection of giving. Remember that dana... For centuries before this text was written, for centuries, dana was understood as the donations that you made to monks, and from which accrued merit to oneself. And instead, now Guna Bahadra says, having no attachments within or without, the great ultimate relinquishment. This is called the perfection of giving. And then he goes on to the second one, Shila, which is morality. Good and evil equal, so neither can be found. This is the perfection of morality. The next one is forbearance or patience in the face of hostility or mistreatment. To have no transgressions amid the objects of mind, the harm of rancor forever ended. This is the perfection of patience. And then the next one is effort. Virya. Great stillness, unmoving, the myriad activities spontaneously so. This is the perfection of energetic progress. So you see the paradox in each of these. That true effort is a no effort. True giving is a no giving. True morality is a no morality, and so forth. The fifth is meditation. It says the flourishing of wondrous stillness. This is the perfection of meditation. And the last one is wisdom or realization. Wondrous stillness opening forth illumination. This is the perfection of wisdom. People who are like this are lofty and vast, taking in everything perfectly without obstruction. achieving rich and varied functioning. This is the great vehicle, the Mahayana. Well, time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.